The opinions expressed on all WRCA programs are those of the program producers and do not express the views of WRCA, its staff, or management.
A member of the Beasley Broadcast Group, this is 1330 WRCA, Watertown, Boston.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the new adventures of Tube Talk. And not only do we celebrate radio tonight, we celebrate our great nation. Ladies and gentlemen, the Boston Pops, Keith Lockhart conducting, and it is only fitting that this of all weeks we open up the show with that song, and even more fitting in that basically our location here allows us to see on our way to the studio every week the Esplanade on the Charles River, the home of the Boston Pops, Boston 4th of July concert and fireworks extravaganza. That has just become part of a fabric of events as we celebrate our nation's founding every year. So we're right down the street from that. And, you know, we see that on the subway when we come over the Longfellow Bridge into Cambridge, because this program is brought to you by the subway, because that's how we get here. Some of the tunnels in the Boston subway system are over 100 years old. We do have trains that are newer than that. But honestly, and no surprise to the radio collectors of America, the older trains run the best. And there also are some odors in the subway that I would hazard are about 100 years old as well. And I've always been fascinated by this. In the summer especially, they will take these gigantic fans, these huge blower fans, industrial size, and blow this odor around. So I have no idea whether that's just another added benefit of riding the subway. The stench can be bad enough at times, but no, it's 98 out. So here, we'll take a fan and we'll blow the odor at you at about 100 miles an hour just to make your ride an even more pleasurable experience. But anyway, we get here and we play some music. We talk to interesting people in the antique radio hobby. We have a blast doing it. And we hope you enjoy it. We've been playing a little cowboy type music on the show lately, so let's keep going with that. This is Marty Robbins.
To the town of our free rode a stranger one fine day. Hardly spoke to folks around him, didn't have too much to say. No one dared to ask his business, no one dared to make a slip. The stranger there among them had a big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip. It was early in the morning when he rode into the town. He came riding from the south side, slowly looking all around. He's an outlaw loose and running, came the whisper from each lip. And he's here to do some business with a big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip. In this town there lived an outlaw by the name of Texas Red. Many men had tried to take him, and that many men were dead. He was vicious and a killer, though a youth of 24. And the notches on his pistol numbered 1 in 19 more. 1 in 19 more. Now the stranger started talking, made it plain to folks around. Was an Arizona ranger, wouldn't be too long in town. He came here to take an outlaw back alive or maybe dead. And he said it didn't matter, he was after Texas Red. After Texas Red. Wasn't long before the story was relayed to Texas Red. But the outlaw didn't worry, men that tried before were dead. 20 men had tried to take him, 20 men had made a slip. 21 would be the ranger with the big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip. The morning passed so quickly, it was time for them to meet. It was 11:20 when they walked out in the street. Folks were watching from the windows, everybody held their breath. They knew this handsome ranger was about to meet his death. About to meet his death. There was 40 feet between them when they stopped to make their play. And the swiftness of the ranger is still talked about today. Texas Red had not cleared leather, for a bullet fairly ripped. And the ranger's aim was deadly with the big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip. It was over in a moment and the folks had gathered round. There before them lay the body of the outlaw on the ground. Oh, he might have went on living, but he made one fatal slip when he tried to match the ranger with the big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip. Big iron, big iron. When he tried to match the ranger with the big iron on his hip. Big iron on his head.
That's Marty Robbins. I'm Paul Burish, your host of Tube Talk. Email the show if you care to get in touch with us. It's TubeTalk1, the number one, at gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. We are here every Friday night, 10 p.m. sharp. An oasis of sanity in the radio world. We're pleased tonight on Tube Talk to have a returning guest, Mr. Ross Hochstrasser, member of New England Antique Radio Club, master clock repairman, and all-around fun radio guy. And tonight we're going to talk a little bit about one of the bigger challenges he's encountered in the world of radio restoration. Ross, thanks for coming on. How's it going?
Oh, very good. Very good. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. And Ross, we always have these conversations with people about different projects, and whenever you talk to somebody who does restoration work, you'll always hear somebody, you know, you mention a set or you say, gee, I like that one over there, and they kind of moan and they go, oh, you don't even want to know what I had to do to get that one back. So we thought we'd ask Ross to share with us one of his greater challenges, and from what you were telling me, it's a Grundig.
Yes, Grundig radios were very well-engineered radios, and they certainly performed very nicely, and they certainly weren't all that cheap. However, they did have some challenging repair scenarios with some of their radios. In the early to mid-1960s, they made a stereo table radio called a 5490, and this was AM, FM shortwave, and FM stereo as well, and you could even buy an optional reverb unit for it, which they actually sounded pretty horrible, but you could get a reverb for them. And the problem with this particular radio is that Grundig, in their push-button scheme on the front, ran out of switch sections to switch between AM and FM. And in order to facilitate doing that, they added another slider, if you will, at the opposite end of the switch assembly. In other words, right behind the off switch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the way that they actuated this off switch was with a pot metal lever that pivoted right smack in the middle of the radio dial on the front, in behind the dial, and it actuated from the FM button and pivoted and then operated a section with two or three more sets of contacts over behind the off switch. And the problem was is that this particular lever, being made out of pot metal, for some reason they had changed the composition of the pot metal from radios that were used that they were making back in the 1950s.
Uh-huh.
It was the exact same lever that was used in the 7000 and 8000 series consoles from 5 years or 6 years before that, but they changed the composition of it. And typically when you buy or acquire a 5490 these days, you open up the back and literally dump the lever out in pieces. Crumbles to dust.
Somebody who is a wise radio restoration guy told me once, he said, every set has its fatal flaw. You know, there's so very few that just, you know, it comes off so easily with. He said, no matter which manufacturer, which model, there's always a particular area that creates a huge hurdle. And it can be a relatively simple thing, but it's either getting the part or, you know, fabricating a part. It just crushes you. You know, you've got everything else under control, and then, ta-da, you know, you get whacked with something like that. How much would one of those sets have gone for, Ross, in its day when it was first out on the market?
I would have to guess
any ideas?
That the 5490 in probably 1962, 63 probably cost in the vicinity of $500.
So
it was not a cheap radio.
Sizable investment.
Very expensive radio. And Grundig had done a lot of interesting things with it. They had push-pull EL95s for the audio output, so it had plenty of power. And they also did something that Saba had started doing years beforehand, and that was incorporating different drivers for speakers. In the mix-up. So, in other words, there's four speakers in the radio, and normally audiophiles, of course, would cringe if they heard this, but typically you would have two speakers identical on left and right channel.
Yep.
And in this particular case, all four speakers are slightly different. And what they did was they overlapped the frequency response characteristics of the four speakers so that you would have slightly different tonality on the left and right channel, but when you stand back 6 feet, the ensemble was pretty breathtaking. It's a fantastic sounding radio.
Sort of like the wall of sound idea. Everybody
Absolutely.
Has its little role to play in the overall sound. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yep, and it really was a very good sounding radio. Had excellent shortwave on it and so forth, but there's this pot metal lever, and in order to replace it, I've done five or six of them in my lifetime, and the last one that I did, I got it down to about 3 hours just to change this lever, because you have to desolder about 20 wires and dismantle the switch assembly and actually lower it down respective to the chassis. I have a chassis stand that I put them up on,
which I believe I've seen. I'm not sure where this there was. Somewhere, I believe you have a couple of shots of your workbench. Maybe it's on the radio attic.
It's on the radio attic, exactly.
Yeah, I've seen that device. That's a nifty device. I like that.
Yeah, there's a Telefunken Hymnus strapped into it in that picture. But putting the 5490 chassis in there, you drop that switch assembly down and take off a circlip and pop that a little pin out and drop the new lever in place, and then reassemble. And it's a lengthy process, and I realized quite a while ago that sooner or later I was going to run out of old 1950s vintage consoles that I could steal those levers out of. And I took one of the levers that was intact to a pattern maker over in Canton, Massachusetts, who's no longer there. And they made a pattern for me for, I think it was about $350 it cost me for the pattern. And they were casting these things up in bronze.
Yikes.
Now, you know as well as I do that that the radio chassis would be completely rusted and rotted away and that bronze lever would still be existing.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably a little bit of overkill. We could have done them out of aluminum and they would have been fine. But one way or the other, I no longer have any of them. I still have the pattern, and the company that was casting them for me isn't around anymore. So I can't make any more of them, and I get requests all the time for these levers. But that particular operation was one that I would avoid like the plague, you know, trying to get that radio apart. The results were worth the effort. I mean, it was very, very impressive-sounding radio. And there's been other approaches to the same problem. I have a technician buddy who lives up in Michigan who was saddled with the same problem at one point. And what he ended up doing was got a multipole relay and offloaded one set of contact on the active end of the switch and wired in a multipole relay to take up the slack, and then just added a little wall wart type power supply tucked in the back of the radio someplace, so that when you switched over to AM, this little relay would engage and finish the switching
right.
that other set of switches did. And that worked. I've done that also on a console for a customer. I years ago, I did the same thing, and it's not a lot less work, but it's a little bit easier to do.
So, you know, it's an interesting dilemma that you found yourself in, and it's one that, you know, occasionally you'll be reading an article or you'll see something online, somebody who chronicles a restoration project, and they always tell you if you can find somebody who's done any machining work or is a machinist or an independent machine shop, and, you know, those are fading rapidly in the United States. I know where there are a couple of them that do work still, but whether or not they'd be willing to help somebody out, you know, they, you know, guys who do cars run into a lot of issues like that. There's just a part that's just not available, and they can't even scrounge one any longer. So, you know, if you looked in, I guess it was Hemmings Motor News, or Hemmings was the publication, you know, you'd find guys who'd run little ads, or you could hook up with somebody who would actually make things, you know, in small runs for people. And sometimes they sort of, if the guy is one of these folks who likes to restore things or see antiques come back to life, they take pity on the automotive or the radio restorer, and they'll say, well, you know, it's not something I really want to get in the business of doing, but let's see what we can do. And, you know, they're very valuable people to know just because they can take something and turn it into the just what you need. Otherwise, you're doomed. You might as well just put the setup on eBay for parts if you can't get it.
Yep, and there's certainly a consortium of talented folks out there that can fabricate pieces and parts. I can make some parts here. I have a little small, very, very small milling machine. I have several lathes here in the shop that I use for the clock repair work that I do. And we occasionally employ those to fabricate little pieces and parts for the radios as well. There are other people out there that we can use. I had a situation a few years ago where I was restoring an Eveready, 1931 Eveready set for a friend of my brother's, and the plat metal tuning dial had crumbled to dust, and I had the remains of it, and I sent it to a guy who I won't name because he'll get deluged, down in New York, and his next-door neighbor was a NASA machinist.
Cool, he's a good guy to know.
He whipped one up out of aluminum that was an absolute dead ringer for the original, except it was shiny. It was just absolutely beautiful, and it was $120 or something. It wasn't outrageously expensive, but I fabricate clutch parts for the Grundigs because they use pot metal clutches also, and we fabricate those up. I can do those right here. I make the new ones out of aluminum or brass.
Complete with a lifetime warranty?
Yeah, well, somewhat. But
now, for the more casual listener here, pot metal is, what is pot metal?
Pot metal,
it's a curse, isn't it?
It is a bit of an enigma. We're not sure.
Could be anything.
What it is. It's a mixture, mainly, from what we can gather, it's mainly a alloy of zinc and tin, maybe even a little bit of lead, but it varies. And I think this is where Grundig hit a brick wall with their particular situation, because the pot metal pieces that I have around here that were made back in 1955, 56, 57, still look like brand new. The ones made after 1960 just fell apart. So somewhere along the line, they changed the formula for their alloy, or the machinist that was making this stuff for them, or the fabricator that was making it for them, changed the alloy. And, you know, it just didn't work. It was just horrible stuff. For whatever reason, the quality of it deteriorated, but it was a very popular material to use all the way back into the 1920s in radios. They were making pot metal pieces for these radios, and you have to understand that companies like Atwater Kent and RCA and Zenith and all of these companies, they did not anticipate that their radios were still going to be chugging along 75, 80 years later. And they also hadn't probably had pot metal in their hands long enough to really understand what it was going to do.
Exactly. So this sort of reminds me of, if you've ever had anything that's an inexpensive appliance or little piece of furniture or a wire doohickey that you might use for storage. You know, I can always remember my father complaining about, he would call them the white metal screws, you know, because it wasn't, you know, they saved 10 cents on the whole unit, but they used something that was an amalgam of cheap metals, and invariably, you know, you get the screwdriver in there, you'd strip the head, they weren't the right, you know, it was cheap, cheap, and cheap, and, you know, the bane of any assembler's existence. So, and again, they probably used it for radio manufacture, it was easy to get, easy to make, relatively inexpensive, and probably very malleable. It was easy to put in a mold and get what you wanted out of it. Something like, is that the rationale behind it?
Yeah, I believe so. And white metal and plat metal are the same thing.
Yeah.
In fact, I've even heard some people refer to it as pig metal for that.
Yeah.
For it, but
derogatory.
Maybe. But it was a material that melted at a very low temperature, and that was the attraction to using it, is that they could make up molds out of less than ideal materials, and the molds wouldn't be damaged by the high temperatures that you'd run into if you were using other materials. I don't think there was a lot of aluminum available in the early part of the 20th century. I think that certainly came along before World War II, but I don't know if in 1920 there was a lot of aluminum around, but at any rate, the pot metal, any radio restorer or restorer of anything, I mean, we run into it now and then in clocks as well, where there's pot metal parts that we can't do anything with unless we fabricate a new one out of brass or bronze or aluminum or something that's a little bit more durable.
Talking about casting, it always reminds me of I come from a long line of plumbers, and my grandfather was the master plumber who taught all the sons, and I can remember he'd let me, I'd get the torch, and, you know, I'd heat it up, and he'd be, would melt the oakum, you know, for the work on the iron pipes and all, and, you know, if you're a hobbyist, you know, maybe the white metal was something that, if you had the ability somehow to make a mold, or had a material you could use for a mold, you might even be able to make some of your own parts at home. Though I don't know how much precision you'd have, and, you know, you might have to do a little filing on it or sanding it. I don't know how you get the burrs off of it and get the shape just right if it didn't come out too good in the first place. But, you know, so maybe a little bit of a blessing and a curse. It's a curse if you're restoring it, but if you're fortunate enough that you're handy enough to maybe make one, make that part that you couldn't get. Maybe it was a blessing. I don't know.
Yeah, well, this is true, and one of the arts, one of the elements of the art of radio restoration, and again, this travels over into other fields as well. People who work with antique toys are saddled with the same dilemma, where they have pot metal that they have to deal with, and there are people who have come up with ways to actually repair it. I don't know how. They probably use a method of heating and annealing the metal somehow to get it back into shape. But this is where the art of radio restoration kind of comes into play, because a fair majority of what we do is replacing capacitors and replacing resistors and rewinding coils and locating parts and so forth. The electronic end of it isn't always the most difficult part.
Right.
It's the mechanical end of things. And when you had radios like, for example, Philco with their little shadow tuner, I've known people who have disassembled those and rebuilt them and put them back together. Again, the mechanical tuning parts, Zenith shutter dial radios have all sorts of little levers and pivots and so forth in there that need to be cared for sometimes. And
push-button mechanisms in general are often fraught with different types of problems, from bent parts to metal that's corroded and or something that might even be missing on it. But I have a Stromberg Carlson that has an automatic tuning feature in it, and it's just... It frightens me. It's one of those things. So for people who don't like challenges, you wonder why they pick 5 and 6 tube sets. You know?
Well,
this is great. It's only got two knobs.
That's right. It's certainly the place to start, that's for sure. And that's what we encourage people getting into it to do, is to find yourself a real basic All-American 5, replace all the capacitors, and then take it from there. And you know, the further you get into the hobby and the more complex radios you end up dealing with, the more rewarding it is, for certain, but also the more challenging it becomes.
Yeah, and I think you need to be a little bit, to your point, it's you know, yes, you need to know your electronics, but then you also need to be a little bit of a machinist, a woodworker, you know, a jack of all trades, to work your way around some of the different material problems you run into, and just to have the knack to make it all work together, which, again, is one of the things that I think amazes me when I see people who put these extremely complex sets from the 30s and 40s back into, you know, museum quality. It's a pretty remarkable feat. So there's the casual observer who just looks over and sees the refinished cabinet, and you look at the chassis, and it looks pretty good because it's been cleaned up and the wiring's fresh, and they say, hey, that's great. But they don't even know the half of it in many cases, do they?
Well, that's true, and that's also assuming that we haven't had any little mousies moving in and setting up camp in the interim. That's one of the worst nightmares, is to open up a radio and find a mouse nest in it. And,
I know.
I think on a previous edition of Tube Talk, I gave a little description of the R390 that I had built a few years ago, which did have a mouse nest. And was a bit of a mess, and that came out nice. But that radio doesn't have any plat metal in it. That's all stainless and brass. So you know,
yeah, military spec stuff. It's a different story.
It cleans up nice. So one of the other radios that I've had to deal with lately, since I spoke to you last, is an RCA 811K console that did have a mouse in it. Although he did not do a lot of damage, or she, as the case may be. But we did have an antenna coil that had been obviously damaged either by lightning or some kind of a high voltage, high current situation. The inside of the can was splattered with beeswax that had melted down on the coil. Looks like a lightning strike to me, but we were able to get that back together. But again, we had to clean up some mousy problems.
Well, you know, it's another good argument, I guess, for having a cat. Maybe one of the few positive things I can think of is I have never seen a mouse in my house during his tenure. But, you know, so you got two things going on, though, too, is you may have had that mouse take up, you know, residence when that radio was sitting in somebody's barn or a garage and, you know, was sitting around for 30, 40 years, and it's just, it's bound to, it's waiting to happen. You know that he's looking for a home. But then again, you know, you might have something that's in pretty good shape, and if you're like some of us in this hobby, you run out of room, so you start to cheat a little bit, and you might put something outdoors in a shed or in your garage, and if it's got access to the outside, that you certainly would not want any rodents getting in after you have obtained your treasure. So I have a RCA 281. It's a monster set. It's an all wave. It's got a double set of doors. The cabinet that's close to the control section and within the doors is absolutely mint. However, it has these very elaborate feet, and they took a beating. It looks like too many, you know, probably those old vacuums that weigh about 250 pounds were getting whacked into them. So it needs some work, but I got it off a fellow in Medfield, Mass, who ran a sign store. He just simply had no room for it. And it was pretty good shape, but $50 takes it away, and you know, just the tubes alone, if they test good, are probably worth the $50. So, but it's one of these things. It's where do I put it? What am I going to do with it? I couldn't pass it up, but on the other hand, I don't really have a plan for putting it somewhere. You know, if it ever can get back to the state that it plays in. So it's in the garage. And it's, you know, I'm monitoring it, though. I go out there, I'll look around, make sure nothing's getting in the back of it. And, again, I will be known to lock the cat in the garage for, like, a couple hours. Just periodically we'll make a sweep to make sure that there's nothing going on in there. And it may sound, again, you know, we say these things to the casual observer, but if you've ever had to clean out the nest and you've ever seen them with all their little cloth and grass and twigs and, you know, stuff that they jam in up against the speaker, and look at all the wires they've been gnawing. They love that insulation. It's just a nasty situation, and it usually is found in a set that you've really wanted to get, and then you got to say, do I want to do this? And your point was also there could be some health hazards with some of the droppings and some of the left behinds from Mr. Mouse.
That's certainly a concern. I have stashed away up in the barn and RCA 816K console, which was their top of the line, and it's a fantastic radio, but boy, the mice got in there and just made a mess. And the urine and the feces from the mice, I don't know that they necessarily carry any disease, but mice do carry something called the hantavirus, and that's something that I don't know much about how you contract the disease, but it's certainly something to be aware of.
And no, it's a bad scene.
Yeah, if you want to handle a radio chassis and clean it up after a mouse has been in there, put on a mask, put on some gloves, get out the disinfectant, and do the best you can with it. But it's not a healthy environment to be dealing with, for sure.
No, you know, and it's not just idle chatter on our part either, because I think it was either last summer or the summer before, there was a story out of one of the national parks where they have these... It's sort of a cabin, but it's sort of a tent, and these little cabin things, for lack of a better term, were for rent. And I can't remember the national park, but essentially the walls were kind of like quilted, you know. So it was a fine spot for some mice, some rodents to get in there, and they were, and they did carry some type of a bug that people were complaining about, and several people got rather ill from it and all. So again, just another hazard to the radio restoration guy. Now, other than your issue there with your pot metal part, how else would you rate that Grundig? Was it a piece of cake?
No. The thing's got about 16 tubes in it.
They're very complex sets, and they're engineered very well, but they take a lot of work, from what I understand.
Yeah. And they also had the pot metal clutches in them, too, but the clutch was easy compared to the bar. And... you know, one of the saving graces in the 5490 is that by the time that radio was made, Grundig had made some changes in their suppliers of capacitors, and the capacitor technology had also changed a little bit. So some of the capacitors that were used in the 5490 are not a shotgun throwaway like they were in the earlier radios. So you can cut a few corners on recapping in that radio. So it's... a little bit easier in that sense, but there's still a lot to it. There's a multiplex decoder that's riddled with all sorts of problems where the coils that are used in the synchronous detection part are glued into the printed circuit board that they're mounted onto the main circuit board with, and the glue crystallizes, and the coils, you know, in the process of carrying the radio around, the coils break loose, and little fine hair wires break, and so multiplex decoders are a big problem in those 5490s. They weren't the only radio that used them, but it adds to the pile on that particular radio, and they need the usual things. The switches need to be cleaned and lubricated, and the tubes need to be checked, and you need to do the alignment, and the filter capacitors and rectifier all have to be done, just like you do on any other radio. But it's easily a $500 to $600 repair job on a 5490, and so far I've never had a refused estimate. Maybe one. I think I did have one where I ended up buying the radio from the customer, but, you know, when you kind of caught me off guard and said, what was the worst radio you had to repair? I had to think about it a little bit, and I thought, oh, yeah, that 5490, that was not much fun. In a slightly different vein, another problematic radio to deal with, and I was just asked to do one of these not long ago, and I sort of refused to do it, is the World War II vintage Hallicrafters SX-28. Not a particularly complex radio, but steel chassis, steel cabinet, and just a very, very heavy radio. I actually have a 28A, which is slightly easier to work on because the band switch assembly can be disassembled into its component parts and worked on independently. But the SX-28 is not a fun radio to deal with. I asked a friend of mine who also does radio restoration if he wanted to tackle it, and he said, sure, for $1,000. And the guy who was interested in having it done didn't want to put that much into it, and I just threw my hands up and said, well, sorry. And I have one of my own that I do need to do some work on, but again, mine's an A. It's a little bit easier.
You know, and you find a lot of people who you will steer away. You know, it always interested me, especially when I was, I'd still say I'm new to a lot of different sections of this hobby, but when you start to talk a little bit to some of the guys who have done a lot of restoration work, you'd find somebody who'd be willing to jump on, you know, a 1934 or a 1935 set if he thought that, you know, the chassis was easy enough to work on, things weren't too cramped underneath, if there was plenty of room to get in there, it seems fairly straightforward. And, you know, then you'd say, well, how about, you know, I guess it was 1937, 1938 when you started to see a lot of rubber insulation show up. And, you know, so then you'd ask the same guy, you know, if you'd like to take something from 1938, 39, and he'd say, all rubber wiring, every bit of it needs to either be recovered or replaced. And they just, you know, they start to see the look on their face, and they'd rather you almost give them some set from the early 30s that at least, you know, some of the cloth-covered wiring, if it was pretty well preserved, you know, they may be able to live with. But the whole rubber-coated wiring thing scares a lot of people. There's 3 or 4 years, I guess, that till they went over to plastic or still went back and used some cloth, that whole issue becomes you know, a major undertaking. And it's the time is really what you wind up paying if you're not doing your own restoration work. You're really paying for the time. It's not so, you know, yes, there's certainly the knowledge and the skill that goes along with it, but it's just the immense amounts of time that it can take to pull it out, put it back in, make sure it's done right, and do it in sequence so that you can go on to the next section of the radio that needs to be repaired. You know, you think you really wind up paying for time more than anything with some of these jobs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I was doing this as a business, you know, people would wonder, why was it that we put $15 worth of parts into the radio, but it was a $300 repair bill? Well, it took a whole day, you know, or a day and a half sometimes. So the hours that you spend can add up really fast. Speaking of rubber wiring, I would probably put that a close second behind pot metal as the worst challenges in radio restoration. I actually have been working on General Electric JE-101, which is a really neat radio, and I acquired it several years ago, mainly because I had a brand new, new-in-the-box GE tuning eye with the GE symbol in the middle
of it. Very nice. Very slick.
I needed a radio to put around it. And,
here we go.
A very good friend of ours down in Connecticut came up with this JE-101 for a very reasonable price. And it actually fired up and played right off the shelf. But I wanted to recap it.
Sure.
Right. So, and I'm halfway through replacing all the rubber wiring, a friend of mine said to me, he says, why are you replacing it all? Just desolder one end or clip one end.
The heat shrink tubing.
Why the heat shrink tubing over it and put it back together? It's like, there you go. Just an idea.
Well, it's another way to attack the problem. And in some cases, I think it might be easier to do than others, given how much space you might have or where things are in relation to each other and all. So I hope that tuning eye tube was really worth this, though, you know?
Well, I hope so. Again, the radio's not done. I started working on it about 3 years ago, and it's sitting on the floor in my shop. And every once in a while, I'll pull it out and replace six more wires and then put it away. And, you know, eventually I'll get it done. It's a really cool table radio. It's a big, big table radio. I think it's got a 10-inch speaker in it, which is pretty good size for a table radio. And it's going to be a well worthwhile piece, because before I recapped it, the sensitivity and the audio quality on it was just really good.
It's interesting. Every now and then, you know, you'll find something that's, you know, for a table set. Like I saw recently online, a guy had a I'm grasping on this model number. It's maybe a Motorola 56 T1 or T2. And it's sort of a pedestrian-looking little set. It has a metal escutcheon. And the thing that kind of caught my eye is, instead of sort of that brass look, that weathered brass look, the escutcheon almost looks to be more like a pewter look, you know, whatever it is. If it was brushed aluminum, I don't know. So it looked a little different and had some push buttons on it. And, you know, it just – so I looked at the shot in the back, and still had the label on it, and it looked to be a fairly high tube count set. So I looked it up at radiomuseum.org, and, well, lo and behold, it has a transformer. I think it had a 6- or an 8-inch speaker, and it had more than 6 tubes, I can say that. So, you know, usually your Motorola's are, you know, 5- and 6-tube sets, you know, from that era. I think this was like a 1941 sort of right just before they stopped making them for the war. And you look at it, and you look at what, you know, he wanted for it, and then you compare it to some of these other little 5- and 6-tube sets. You say, well, here's something. It even has a 3-gang tuning condenser, from what I understand. So it's a sleeper. It's in this kind of a plain-looking little case, but it's a nice chassis. It's probably a great performer, and it'd probably be much better for your collection. And he didn't want much more for that one than for a lot of the other ones that were your basic All-American 5s, but maybe they were in a more eye-catching cabinet or had a little bit more zip to them. So it is interesting when you'll find something, I don't know what's the term for it, a sleeper maybe, that something that really wows you. You don't expect too much out of it, and it turns out to be a great set.
Yep. I think you could also call it the wolf in sheep's clothing syndrome. if you look on Radio Attic Archives under Emerson.
Yes, you've talked to me about this before, yes.
Yeah, there's a 534 in there that's actually mine, and it's an Emerson table radio with 10 tubes in it, and that was pretty off the beaten path for Emerson. They were into 5- and 6-tube cheap radios, this has got the 3-gang tuning cap with the extra tuned RF stage in the front end, a very elaborate loop antenna on the back. It had a push-pull 6 V6s in it for audio output, so it's got a little bit of oomph to the audio section. And it's a real performer. It's not a particularly pretty radio, but it catches you a little bit by surprise when you take the back off and look in and go, "Oh my God, this is a boat anchor in a wood case."
Yeah, it's an interesting thing too, because you're right. That's a maker that a lot of people kind of poo-poo and will say, "Eh, well, you know, some of their cabinets were okay because they had the Ingraham cabinets, and you know, some sound halfway decent." But in general, people who are into higher tube count sets or, you know, more electronically evolved sets would look at those and say, well, you know, that's an Emerson. But,
yeah,
you know, and then, you know, maybe the engineering department was just running a special that day. You know, we know all this stuff. Why don't we ever use it? So let's make one.
Well, take a look sometime when you get a chance. Again, under Emerson, there were only, I think, 3 or 4 models that came under the heading DS, Delta Sierra. I think the fourth 435 or 432 or something like that. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. But it's a pretty unpretentious-looking table radio. Until you get up close to it and you notice that it's an AM-only table radio with a tuning eye. And I bet you can't think of too many models out there that were produced with a tuning eye that didn't have a shortwave.
Right.
Usually the tuning eye was preserved for that. Well, it's a 9-tube table radio with a 6-inch high-compliance speaker that faces up through a grill on the top of the radio. And the audio section is a pair of 6L6s in push-pull. I mean, this is what they did in PA amplifiers and guitar amplifiers.
Sure.
Modulators on transmitters and stuff. It's a table radio, an AM-only table radio.
That's cool.
Made by Emerson, and it's got a tuned RF stage in the front end, three-gang tuning cap, and just bucket loads of audio. And I've never had one in my hand, and it's not a radio that I'm pining to own, but I certainly would love to spend an afternoon with one.
Yeah, you know, it'd be fun to DX with something like that, I would think. You'd, you know...
Yeah.
Between the sensitivity and the output, you know, you'd probably take a small signal and do a lot with it.
Yeah, you can turn it on and crank the volume up and then walk downtown and listen to it. You know, it's it seems like a pretty formidable radio. And, again, I if anybody out there has one that I can borrow for an hour, I'd love to have it for an hour.
They can email the show. TubeTalk1 at Gmail. That's right. You know, I have a Stuart Warner, and I... 62. I can't pull the number out of a hat, but it's one of their first models right after the war. So they just recommenced manufacture. And it's kind of an odd set. I got it off a real old timer, and he had done some work on it, and it was just kind of caught my eye. And so when I got it, you know, finally got the thing off of him. You know, it still has the setup where the speaker is to the side of the chassis, which is sort of the, you know, an earlier 30s or pre-war fashion. And they started putting, to make the cabinet smaller, that stick the speaker right in front. But it's still, which I'm kind of fond of having the speaker off to the side. It opens things up in there. And I looked a little further, and it had the permeability tuning. It has slug tuning instead of, you know, what we normally see. So I wasn't really quite sure about this thing, but I have to say, all things considered, it's got this big 6-inch Quam Nickel speaker in it. It's one of my better-sounding sets, and I found some old ads online, some guys who had shot some ads from the catalog, I guess, that Stuart Warner had put out. And they sort of, again, couldn't tell you the electronic rationale behind this. It could all just be advertising schmaltz. Sort of a high fidelity sound. Well, I don't think it's a high fidelity in the sense of some of the, you know, big Philcos or those that had the the bandwidth that you is it what why would you have almost high fidelity in a set? What did they do to the I'm losing it, Ross. Help me.
you're probably referring to the IF bandwidth.
Yes.
The high fidelity. High fidelity and selectivity are a seesaw. They operate inversely to each other. You can have a radio with really good selectivity, and you suffer a little bit on the high frequency response of the audio, a little bit. Or you have a radio that's really tight that you can tune stations in that are close together, but your audio is probably
suffers
not
a little bit, right? Right.
And so you sacrifice one for the other, unless you have a switch and you can select the selectivity down to where you need it. Those sort of features were typically just on radios with shortwave, not so much on AM radios. But the high fidelity radios, they usually started at the audio output section. They put a better quality speaker in, push pull audio output, you know, two tubes instead of one. And, you know, maybe a better quality output transformer and, you know, things like that. So they start from the back end and work forward. And, again, you know, what they actually end up doing is reducing the Q of the IF transformers a little bit to fatten them up and make them a little bit wider. And, again, this you sacrifice a little bit of selectivity for it, but you feel like you're right there at the ball game when you're
right.
Listening to it.
And in this, in many cases, is why if you talk to some people who have fortunate enough to have a set like this, will tell you that, you know, well, it doesn't have to be FM. You know, if you've ever listened to one of those sets, you get a much better sound reproduction, and in many cases, people are kind of, you know, marvel that, gee, that's only a, you know, an AM signal. But it is interesting, and that little Stuart Warner, strangely enough, I guess Stuart Warner made a lot of private label stuff. Alan Finger had a Firestone at a couple of shows ago that he had worked on, and it was the same chassis as we took a look in at it, and I guess they had slapped the Firestone label on them at one point in time, and he thought it was pretty well made and enjoyed the sound of it as well. So, you know, again, these nice little finds, you know, when you take a chance sometimes on something, it doesn't always work out that way, but many times you do get pleasantly surprised. So,
yeah, those are the fun radios. You know, I had a little Grundig in here. In fact, I think I still have one upstairs called a 2006 UKW. Dates from about 1952 or 53. Has a plastic speaker. The basket is actually plastic with a magnet bolted onto it, and you know, the usual conventional oval type cone and so forth. The radio uses an EL41 audio output tube, which is a real oddball, and wasn't a real high-end radio. It was the 2000 series, and Grundig radios got better with the bigger numbers, so a 4000 and 5000 series radio would be top of the line, and here's this lowly 2000 series radio, and the audio quality on that radio would just knock you over. It was a very impressive little radio to listen to, and some of my radio buddies and I always rate a radio by how difficult it is to shut it off. You know, I had a real hard time turning that one off because it sounded so good. I just didn't want to turn it off.
That's an interesting meter. I like that metric. You know, and that presents a topic for a future show, I would think. Radios that on the first look, you know, they have no reason sounding as good as they do, and why is that? You know, sometimes you'll find these real gems, things that turn out, you know, to be, you know, way better than your first impression would be when you take a look at it, or even if you take a peek in the back, but you dive in a little further. Well, hey, Ross, I know you have another commitment this evening, so I really appreciate you finding some time in your schedule. Thanks for the enlightening talk, and hopefully we'll talk to you again sometime soon. Have a great night.
Okay, you do the same, Paul, and we'll see you further down the logbook, as they say.
73s, right?
73s.
You take care, Ross.
You too. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Whistle down a line. I figure that it's engine number 49. She's the only one that'll sound that way on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. See the old smoke rising round the bend. I reckon that she knows she's gonna meet a friend. Folks around these parts get the time of day from the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. Here she comes. Ooh, hey Jim, you better get the rig. Ooh, she's got a list of passengers that's pretty big, and they'll all want lifts to Brown's Hotel, 'cause lots of them been traveling for quite a spell, all the way from Philadelphia, on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
All aboard!
Let her rip, let her rip, Mr. Engineer. Gotta go far away from here. While the man at the fire shovels on the coal, stick your head out the cab, watch the drivers roll. See the towns and the roads go whizzing by. Fare thee well, Laramie, Albuquerque High. Yes, sirree, here we are going all the way.
Boss will quit till we hit California. Santa Fe.
better get the ring. She's got a list of passengers that's pretty big, and they'll all want lifts to Brown's Hotel, 'cause lots of them been traveling for quite a spell.
All the way from Philadelphia,
on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
Thanks again to Mr. Ross Hochstrasser for being our informative and very educational guest this evening. Ross, it's always a treat to have you on. So glad you could find some time to come on and talk on Tube Talk. And that's a little Johnny Mercer, a Johnny Mercer Harry Warren composition. There's a couple of American heavyweight songwriters for you. On the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe with the Pied Pipers. And that's a fun piece. I love that. Could listen to that all night long. Thanks again for listening tonight, gang. We sincerely appreciate it. Tell your friends. You can find us on WRCA 1330 AM, streaming on their website. Also, you can get WRCA on iHeartRadio and tune in. Thanks again for listening. Have a great one. See you next week. And where we're just around the 4th of July here, in keeping with the spirit of things, here's another shot of the Pops.
Yeah.